Good. Welcome, everybody. Nice to see you, David and Clay. I haven't seen you in a long time. And Terry's here. It's great to have you all coming in. So we have been, for these last couple of nights, hanging with one koan that we're running through the whole retreat. And that koan is the storehouse of treasures opens by itself. You may take them and use them any way you wish. So Wednesday night we talked about the storehouse of treasures opens by itself. And last night we really talked about you may take them. And so tonight we're talking about and use them any way you wish. A storehouse of treasures opens by itself. You may take them and use them any way you wish. So last night as we talked about you may take them and use them, this was the meeting on the bare ground. You may take them. And that asks something of you, which is to have a way, to be ready to meet them, to be ready to meet this burgeoning, unfolding that is constantly, that is the constant. And we found it in two contexts. First, the wild, deconstructive approach of Taoism, where we become the absence, the open lens in which presence enters, appears. You can't get much more naked than that. So even more naked an image than standing on the bare ground with open hands, yeah, to be the absence itself. And then we talked about that we met the mythopoetic voice of the Vimalakirti Sutra, which with all its Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, monks, wise laymen, goddess, disciples, the 32,000 beings in the 10-foot room, still arrives in the same place. The open-hearted, empty-handed, naked encounter with this, which is the Dharma. Ain't no other Dharma. And for those of you who weren't here, we also talked about this wonderful experiment that you may have heard about, a project called Project Luma, which is looking at how to heal the neurological foundation of amblyopia in adults, a wandering eye, yeah, or sometimes called a lazy eye, involving the treatment of going into the complete dark for 5 to 10 days. And the two men who did this together, the head researcher and an undergraduate who spent 5 days in the dark together. The researcher came up with the term for them, or maybe they did together, they decided they were scotonauts. So if you hear me referring to scotonauts, you know that's us. But the reference is to that. So this sailing in the dark. So at the very beginning of the Vimalakirti Sutra, we said the Buddha, responding to Shariputra's question, you say this is the Pure Land? This difficult, mucky place of war and famine and heartache and repetitive failure, this? And the Buddha gets off his dais and digs his toes into the earth. He shows it. He simply shows it. And then Vimalakirti says how, if you want it, it's right here. Just give up all your ideas about what it is. That's all. Sailing in the dark. And of course, this is really just simply about us, yeah? Our moment by moment experience of this, you know, this very blue and green carpet, this very room full of us, and the air of late autumn evening, early autumn, late evening. And it's also about what helps, and that's where we're going tonight. You know, what about when you stub your toe, or when the world dies and you want to help? So tonight, I'd like to continue weaving these two entrances together as we take up the third part of our koan, yeah? And use them any way you wish. So to begin with, a reminder of the Taoist Chan perspective from David Hinton. He says, Lao Tzu spoke of flowing water as the form of his Tao. Mind moving through the occasions of its attention, like water through stones and branches and colorful leaves. Sometimes loud and sometimes silent, sometimes seething with light and other times lost in shadow. Yeah. Mind moving through the occasions of its attention. Isn't that a gorgeous expression? Mind moving through the occasions of its attention. Like water through stones and branches and colorful leaves. Sometimes loud and sometimes silent. Your mind, this mind. Sometimes loud, sometimes silent. Sometimes seething with light, and other times lost in shadow. Does that sound like anybody's meditation today, by any chance? So the Taoist saw empty mind in still water. That, here's Hinton again, that dark mirror replacing the arbitrary contingencies of self with an identity expansive as the mountain distances and bottomless skies it mirrors. That happens too in meditation sometimes, yeah. Or I saw you guys lying under the sky in the corpse pose, I guess. I thought, there it is. An identity expansive as the mountain distances and the bottomless skies it mirrors. And then we have the cosmos, this statement. Over the last couple of nights, I think I've talked about how we are just this bit of the cosmos looking at itself. And I found this nice passage touching on this. The cosmos is a tissue of generative chi energy. I love that word tissue because it has a sense of thinness as well as weave, right? So it's not something heavy and dense so much as it is something light and miraculous. A tissue of generative chi energy. And when the eye opens sky inside us, when the eye opens sky inside us, it conjures consciousness as an opening in that tissue. So if you just relax into that image of the eye, yeah, your big eye of attention, that open absence is what he's talking about, and this eye, which is that, actually. When the eye opens sky inside us, it conjures consciousness as an opening in that tissue. I love this conjure, this magic act, yeah? Magically, because we don't know how, consciousness appears as that sky opens. It's opened inside us. It is the opening through which the cosmos is aware of itself. It is the opening through which the cosmos is aware of itself, because we are not other than that. We can only be everything being aware of itself, because we're made of everything, yeah? We are it. We are in every way it. So when the eye opens that sky consciousness inside of us, it is opening itself inside of us, yeah? Aware, conscious. That's the storehouse of treasures opens by itself. Us do it, wins. But then we cut fold back to what Hinton said in that first quote. It's dynamic, it's always changing, yeah? Your mind is never static, moment by moment by moment, yeah? So, like flowing water, yeah? Moving through the occasions of its attention. So then what happens here? What is this, you may take it and use it? So we're sort of getting to the and use it part. If we, our minds, are the opening through which cosmos, everything, is aware of itself, then what is generated, this generative tissue he's talking about? What is generated and how? What is the birth? What is this birth? What is this creativity? When we accept the offer the world makes, remember last night, as Joan Sutherland puts it, to be an unbalanced being in an unbalanced world. Can you see the connection with that stream, with that ever-moving stream, the occasions of our attention? Yeah? That can't be other than unbalanced, because balance is static. Yeah? The stream of our attention meets the vagaries of rock and stick. So what does that look like, and what does it do? To fold back for those of you who weren't here, we also then said that for that first night, the storehouse of treasures opens by itself. That's the first of our three treasures, isn't it? That's Buddha, that's awakening. Yeah? The awakening that we're made of, the awakening that is ongoing, the awakening that happens in us as it happens everywhere. That unfolding constant, yeah? Then the second, that you may take it, that's Dharma. When you encounter it, when you enter yourself completely and open to it, let it enter. When you meet it, actually, with everything too, then that's Dharma. This our second treasure. So we now are in the territory of Sangha, which might seem odd at first. How are we talking about Sangha? Well, we're talking about the generativity in us and in cosmos being woven together. Yeah? The creativity of cosmos meets the creativity of us as cosmos, as everything. Okay? And that means to be an unbalanced being in an unbalanced world. Isn't that odd? Because we think of unbalanced as a, whoa, trouble, right? But what if this unbalanced is the very condition of our creative response to the world? Yeah? What if that's the offer? And our response is to go ahead, go right ahead, and be an unbalanced being in an unbalanced world. What is that like? What does it look like? What does it do? So we encounter Sangha, our companions. Because when the cosmos is aware of itself, that means I am aware of you. And the geese flying in their V or their Y or their sometimes W. And the crab apples in their red roundness bedecking the tree down the street above us, and the knees that hurt, and you, and the geese, and the crabapple tree are doing something. Responding. Aware, each in its way, in a dance that's way, way bigger than our understanding. I am aware of you. You are aware. And sometimes that awareness doesn't look like anything we recognize. Sometimes it's our microbiome that responds. And we don't even know it's happening. And yet, that too is a kind of awareness. Yeah? Of cosmos, aware of cosmos. And sometimes we might play ukulele and cello duets in the dark and find a new friend while exploring a treatment for amblyopia, a wandering eye. Isn't this a treatment for wandering eye, guys? We'll come back to this later. So this is a very subversive move. As Joan points out in her talks on the Vimalakirti Sutra, this meeting what shows up and showing up for it, this is the move that embodies not to. This is the move that embodies not making dualities. by turning under. That word subvert is interesting, isn't it? Vert is turn, sub is under. So I think of it as plowing it under, you know, not like trying to destroy, not trying to get rid of. But if we see this subversion as plowing under our old ideas, plowing under our beliefs and opinions and, you know, quarrels with life, to make fresh, fragrant, new, open ground. When there's just the grasses lit in slant late sun, or tears in someone's beautiful eyes, or passionate hatred or death, when we turn under our dualities, our divisions of everything into I and you, okay and not okay, in and out, and stand open-handed, we undercut that trick of the mind. And this is what we call the sword that cuts into one. The sword that cuts into one. Sometimes we sort of want to reject that image of cutting, and yet sometimes that thing, just like late light on a yellow leaf, or a pigeon landing in a tree, or the thump of someone's foot on the floor, or suddenly realizing the floor has hills and valleys in it. Sometimes that does interrupt, like a cutting, interrupt the old, crusty, wall. And suddenly there isn't anything else, anything other. So then what becomes possible? Connection, yeah? In the absence of disconnection, what's possible is connection. Bringing things back together. And isn't that our deepest wish? Isn't that the way, way deep yearning that surfaces when we get quiet? Isn't this what brings us back into the presence of what is real, which is fundamentally undividedness? So duets happen and symphonies. You may use them any way you wish. Here we are, right smack in our world. And here's our third treasure, Sangha. The Sangha of all beings. Because there is no one way to be a bodhisattva. There simply isn't, and there couldn't be. In the middle of this constant, inconceivable unfolding, opening, opening, opening that never stops, how could there be one way to meet that? So this Guanyin, who will take them and use them any way she wishes is all us. We are her thousand arms, each with a hand, and each hand with its unique eye, its unique view, its unique color of nail polish. There's no one thing to do. You know, there's only the thing you do. And that is always at least a duet, if not a symphony. So in the Vimalakirti Sutra, Manjushri asks, what is compassion? Asks Vimalakirti, what is compassion? And Vimalakirti answers, whatever good you do is completely shared with all beings. So Manjushri asks, what is compassion? And Vimalakirti says, whatever good you do is completely shared with all beings. So this is in the context of Manjushri having asked about his sickness, about why is he sick, yeah? And his saying that that sickness is itself coming from, is an instance of great his great compassion. And that being, I share the condition of all beings. Yeah, I'm sick because all beings are sick. Not as a, that caused this in the mechanical sense, but as a, I share the condition of all beings. Of being an unbalanced being in this unbalanced world. Yeah? And then, here's the other half of that is, I share the condition of everyone, and I share my condition with everyone. I share what I am, whatever good I am, whatever good I do. Yeah? Whatever good you do is completely shared with all beings. So you let the world affect you, and you let yourself affect life. So coming back to our koan, you may take them. Can you let yourself? You may take them and use them any way you like. Put that next to Vimalakirti's, whatever good you do, you share with all beings. What's interesting to me here is this. If we come back to that idea of that talking about the cosmos, yeah? The cosmos as you flows out into the cosmos as not you. And the cosmos we are used to thinking of as not me flows into. And there is this completely mutual interweaving while you are you and it is it. You let the world affect you and you let yourself life. So coming back to whatever good you do, or in the words of our koan, you may take them and use them any way you wish. So let's put whatever good you do next to any way you wish. As I did this, what I noticed was, what I love is, there's no question about the goodness of what you wish. We don't tend to believe ourselves that in ourselves that way, do we? You may take them and use them any way you wish. To me, there's a profound confidence in the goodness of life altogether, of us as an instance of life altogether. Yeah? You may take them and use them. Because we're not so much the judge of that, are we? You know, how good do you think you are at judging the goodness of your own being? How kind are you to you your judgments of yourself? So don't worry about it. Can you trust? What about that? And because these treasures generate basic goodness, they are it, right? When you are watching those geese flying over and hearing their voices, do you have any question about the basic goodness of that? When you are lying in the grass and looking up into that endless sky, is there any question about the basic goodness of that? Is there anything in you that is not good at that moment? This constant unfolding, opening, its nature is basic goodness. All of it, all of it, all of it. It's already you. Which says nothing, has nothing to do with trying to save people or being a savior. Can you feel the difference? You may take them and use them. Any way you wish is not the same as, and now you will vow to save everybody. It feels real different to me anyway. Like when I you know feel that, and now I, the compassionate one, will with my great compassion save everybody, I feel like a brick or a ton of bricks. I don't know how it is for you, but there is no lightness in that for me whatsoever. But you may take them and use them any way you wish. I feel like the fairy godmother. And look out, here I come with my wand. Who knows what might happen? So, can we imagine that in the constant unfolding, opening of everything, all together undivided, that is the actual nature of our experience, including the really, really hard stuff, including, you know, including our friend who's dying, including our friend who died, including the refugees, including all of it, including all of my massive fuck-ups, all of it. I don't think I have a magic wand without all of it. Don't think it happens. It's just being who you are, doing what you do. Being who you are, doing what you do. In good moments and bad.
Maybe that's the magic wand.
Yeah. This is how we live in a world full of suffering and don't turn away. I take what I am, and you take what you are. And we bring it all on to meet what we meet. Together. We're doing it together. And Vimalakirti says further that just being willing to learn this is already compassion. Just being willing to learn it is already compassion. We don't have to be already fully cooked, ready to put, able to drop everything at all times and stand there being fully the open lens, yeah? Fully responsive. We don't have to, the definition of compassion is not already having arrived there. It starts with being willing to learn it. You don't have to want to. You don't have to like it very much. Isn't that interesting? We get to do it, kicking and screaming and grousing and swearing. We do. But we just do it. We're willing. And I was reminded of that wonderful film, Zanskar, Journey to Zanskar. That wonderful Geshe, whose name, unfortunately, I can't remember, in the middle of the night, in a night when he thought they were all going to freeze to death because things had gone so wrong, and they were in this little bitty shelter, and it was how many degrees below, I can't remember, and snowing, and the horses hadn't shown up. And he thinks that they might very well all die that night. Some of you may remember this. And he's sort of musing, you know, with the camera running, and he says, I'm not a bodhisattva. I just took bodhisattva vows. With this kind of 2 a.m. bemusement. What was I thinking? You know? That's this. Yeah? We just get to be willing to learn it. So going back to something Joan says, so the assumption from the view of great compassion is that the good we do belongs to the world, not to ourselves. And our task is to allow it to flow into the world and change the world, to make it part of the world as much as we can. That means to make you just as you are, the you that's sitting here, to let that you-ness, as it shows up, to let it flow into the world and become part of it. Not the you that you're going to perfect someday. This one. I'm not a bodhisattva. I just took bodhisattva vows. We bring the grace of the possibility of change into the world that way, don't we? If we can allow ourselves, if we can be willing to let the good that is us, just let it flow into the world, what we're doing is bringing the grace of the possibility of change, the possibility of our change, the possibility of the world's change, the reality of change. But to bring the grace of that, to be willing to let it into the world, that's not such a shabby calling. So, finally, maybe, There's something I love about this, this as the third treasure, Sangha. If we see Sangha as this flow both ways, yeah? If that's what Sangha is this flow both ways, then Sangha is offering you the opportunity, and you, as also Sangha, are offering, are making something new, unique out of that opportunity. Yeah? Sangha, this us and our world, are offering us the opportunity. We're doing it with each other all the time. Every time we step on each other's toes, every time we laugh together, every time we make something and fail to make something, and break something and fail to break something. We are, that Sangha is offering you the opportunity. And you, the Sangha, are making something new out of that opportunity, something never seen before. Something new is possible because of you. That's the real truth. You may take them and use them any way you wish. That's freedom. So I think I'm stopping there after all, because I'd like to hear your what's going on with you.
So Sarah, when you were talking about the good that I do for all beings. So yesterday I went over to the neighbor's house and Laura was back from another short stint in jail. And she gave me a hug, and I was hugging her, and I said, "Welcome back home." And she said, "Oh, so you know about my little escapade." And I just said to her real quietly while I'm hugging her, he says, "We all make mistakes. We all make mistakes." Mm-hmm. She seemed to be really touched by that. It wasn't anything I had planned out. It just spontaneously arose. And then, I had this response from her, and I realized I was saying it as much for myself as for her. And I don't know, that image and that feeling just kept coming.
Yeah.
Kept coming back to me. And the other thing was the fighting and the kicking and screaming. I thought about taking care of my mom.
Yeah.
I think every time there was a change that required something more of me, I went into the kicking and screaming.
Yeah.
And did it anyway, somehow.
Yeah.
I'm not even sure how.
Yeah.
It's kind of wonderful when that happens, you know?
Yeah.
So Sarah, I'm thinking about the precepts. Do you feel any tension here between the vows that make up the precepts and the any way you choose?
No, I don't actually, but I'm interested in what you might be noticing.
Well, it feels like a tension to me.
Uh-huh. So would you say a little more about that?
Well, any way you choose doesn't say choose life rather than death.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Choose generosity rather than stealing.
Mm-hmm.
And say anything about one choice over another.
Right. It's interesting, isn't it?
Precepts do.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Precepts say, I vow not to kill.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't say, I vow to do whatever I want in a situation of killing.
Right. So a couple of things about that. One of the really subversive, I think, qualities of this way of looking at it is that it goes underneath the precept, I guess is the way it feels to me. So the precept is acknowledging, for example, that so in a world where the Dharma is one, not having thoughts of taking life is the vow of not killing. And then Dogen says, the Buddha's seed grows when you don't take life. Pass on the Buddha's seed and do not kill. So take that as a for instance.
Mm-hmm.
So, as I understand it, when awareness opens to this constantly generative existence, yeah, that is at the same time completely spacious and completely full. At that moment, yeah, which is how I would, another way to describe the storehouse of treasures opens. At that moment, when that storehouse of treasures opens of itself, and we're there, yeah, it opens for us, in other words. In that moment, the Dharma, the way it is completely present. So what Bodhidharma is saying about the Dharma, in a world where the Dharma is, and I can't remember that part, is completely alive, that in that place, yeah, in that place, as that unfolds, as that treasury unfolds, you can take that and use it any way you wish. Because you're not going to do harm with that.
Right. You're going to go with the flow.
Because you're going to just respond. And sometimes it'll be a mistake. Most times it'll be a mistake. Always it'll be a mistake from some point of view. But it's going to enter the world with goodness. You can count on it. Because in the presence of that unfolding, basic goodness is visible, is active. And you'll choose something, and sometimes it'll be a horrible mistake, but it will be the way the cosmos is going on, and you can count on that. Does that make sense?
Yeah, if you're assuming that you're in the flow. I'm just...
Well, and this is talking about
the
precepts
that. Precepts are speaking to you in the flow.
Well, I think the precepts are speaking to us in wherever we are. But you were saying, does this contradict the idea that we need precepts? No, to me it's not at all. But it's going underneath that and saying, in the presence of awakening, we still are going to need to take it. We individually are going to take it and use it. And we can use it any way we wish. With confidence. Does that address that at all?
Sure. You're speaking from a particular perspective, and I think part of our problems with dualism is that it gets us off of that perspective.
Yeah, and we don't live in that moment all the time. So I'm glad you brought that up, because remember when I was talking about the stream, is where it is in the momentary vagaries of what our attention meets, and so that's real too. So I'm not wanting at all to get us stuck in some absolute. We're talking about the ongoingness of being. And in the ongoingness of being, we need all the help we can get. And the precepts really help.
The precepts help ground you in that perspective where you do have choice, but still you have a kind of orientation from which you make your choice.
Well, and they help by being a rock in the stream that'll grab your attention, when you need it. Who knows how they manage to come up when you need them? I don't know. Does that connect?
You're fine.
My mind was kind of going, I think, a similar direction as Robert's. And when the storehouse of treasures opens up, you may use it any way you wish.
Yeah.
Using brings to mind for me manipulation, the imposition of will, the imposition of a conceptual framework onto what's happening.
Yeah.
A sense of distortion.
It's an interesting word, isn't it? You may take them and use them. Yeah.
Yeah, and so I know conceptually, and sometimes I know experientially, that if I do that, if I act in deluded ways, that is in itself part of my Buddha nature expressing. It's an expression of my Buddha nature too, but I'm just not there. I just don't. I don't think I get that in my bones. And I think bringing in the precepts is another way of saying the same thing. It's kind of like if I use the storehouse of treasures for self-gratification and for pain avoidance and for bolstering a self-image or a self-concept, and I cause suffering by doing that to myself and to all these others in the world. How is that okay? It's like, how is that part of what is perfect? And, the Dharma wheel turns, and so the lessons are learned, and I grow from that, and others grow from what I do, and so we all unfold, it all unfolds. And so even if it is creating a lot of suffering in that karmic kind of play, I guess I have faith that it ultimately will unfold in a way that is beautiful. But I just barely.
Right.
I don't always have faith in it.
Right. So I want to go back to one thing you said. Suppose I take the storehouse of treasures and use it. So I'm not sure how you're understanding this storehouse of treasures there. So give me a for instance. Suppose you take what? Because if we're talking, the storehouse of treasures is not a thing, mm-hmm. right? It's the opening itself. It's this the perpetual opening into now of this.
Okay.
Yeah. The actual of this, not our story about it. So the storehouse of treasures opening is this. Is this in its full reality, yeah, with no overlay.
Okay, well that is kind of how I was seeing it.
Okay, so if you take this and use it to bolster ego, what would that be? Can you give me a for instance of that?
Well, you talked about the beautiful light on the yellow leaf.
Okay.
And so the recognition of that and the joy that can bring, the sense of beauty and the sense of intimacy with that,
yeah,
can be taken and used as a tool to bring me wealth by somehow capturing that, inflating it, bolstering it, you know, expressing it in ways that are for my own advancement.
Uh-huh.
See what I'm saying?
I do. I think. I may.
So I mean, intellectual property is all about that kind of stuff. You uh-huh. know, taking one's growing consciousness and making it into a tool to generate recognition and prestige.
Okay. So what we talked about last night was the take it, you may take it part, and that kind of taking that we were talking about is a little different, I think, than what you're talking about, because if you take that moment for the use of ego, then in a way you have already lost that moment. It's not that moment that you're taking, because what you're relating to actually is your ego. What you're relating to is your sense of self at that moment. So at least as I understand it, the moment where of sunlight on leaf is gone already. That encounter may have happened briefly, but if you cannot bear to be there naked with it, if you at the moment when you immediately have to pick up again all of your ideas and lay them on it and say I could use this, then I don't think that's what the koan's talking about. I think what the koan's talking about is you can receive this dharma. You can receive the dharma of the yellow leaf in your complete absence. It can be present. And that's pretty hard to make money off of. I think the thing that's going to make you money is when you let all of the ego stuff come in and you're really just relating to that. You're relating to your story about the leaf. And you can sell your story about the leaf, but you can't actually sell the sunlight on the leaf. I don't know, does that connect for you?
You bet.
Yeah, I like that a lot.
Yeah.
I thought it was cherry.
Kind of captures it. Mm-hmm.
But then, so give an example of how you would use it any way you want. It seems like it's just there, it just is.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And now the idea of using it baffles me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, nice. I that word really stopped me in my tracks. Use it. Mm. So for instance, a story. For some reason, what comes up is making oatmeal. That's a for instance. There it is. You got oats. You got boiling water. It's pretty interesting when they get together. and we get to eat it. I mean, honest, I'm sorry, it seems so simplistic, but I think that's an example.
Okay.
Also, you when you take people birding, there's something that you love. There's an experience that has lit you up. And there's something you're intensely curious about and fascinated by. And you use it when you take people birding. You make something of it. You bring it out to somebody. And it's not easy. People sometimes get there and they're like, uh-oh, I've got this person in my group. Or what, you know? Or, you know, okay, we've planned this whole, I mean, I don't even know what happens with you on your birding. I was just trying to bring it to something that I think is part of your life. But the unexpected happens, right? It's not always a party. Yeah?
Maybe this is why I asked last night. If it opens of itself, you may use it as you wish. But also, is it using you and the outcomes? Now, you used it as you wish,
yes.
But the outcome could be anything.
Absolutely. You may use it as you wish, and then you get to see what happens.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Surprise! Yeah. Yeah, yeah. And is it using you? Absolutely.
It's hugely open-ended, that is.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
When I was 12, I was trying to learn how to do gymnastics. Because I couldn't do them, and I knew that the next year in the seventh grade I was going to have to do, like, in a PE class, and I was, you know, I was an A student, and I didn't want to get.
So you were going to get prepared.
That's right. It was completely selfish. So I practiced that whole summer, learning how to do cartwheels and one arm cartwheels and back bends and just in the front yard. And my sister, who was, I think, 6 at the time. Maybe 7, and her friend came along, and they got involved, and so I started coaching them, and we made up routines, and we did all these, you know, the somersault, I can't even remember the name, it was almost on the tip of my tongue, but anyway, so that was the summer I ended up getting, I think, a C or a D in the class, because you had to get on the balance. I mean, they were really tough. That was scary. Oh. But anyway,
the injustices of it all.
You had to cartwheel down.
Anyway, years later, I don't know if this has anything to do with anything. It was all my own, you know, not wanting to fail, my fear of failing.
Yeah.
And so, I see this friend of my sister's as a grown up, and she says, "You were my inspiration. I became a gymnastics coach."
Oh my God!
She made it her career. And all I was doing was trying not to fall off the balance beam. I was afraid. I don't know if that explains it.
Totally. That is totally yes. That is so beautiful.
Used me.
You took them and used them, and they took you and used you. Yeah, totally.
It's the outcomes that TB was talking about before.
Yeah.
You do this, you have no idea what outcomes are going to come, or how many hundreds of years it's going to be before you can see it.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, it's true. You thought the outcome was getting a D on the damn balance beam, and instead, this woman's off coach of the Olympics.
Oh, man. Okay, that's totally awesome. Thank you. I think we should stop here with our bellies full of that wonderful story. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.